In October 2015, we sat down with some administrators, faculty, and staff of the SUNY College of Optometry to have a discussion about the changing nature of healthcare and how the college is adapting to these changes. The following is an edited version of that conversation.
I'm David Heath, President.
Ludovina Martinez-Gonzalez, Vice President for Clinical Administration of the University Eye Center.
Erica Shulman, Assistant Clinical Professor.
David Troilo, Dean for Academic Affairs.
Richard Soden, Director of Healthcare Development. I think it's important to recognize that with the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, that really set the stage for dramatic changes in healthcare, such as movement away from fee-for-service, movement towards reimbursement based upon quality reimbursement, movement away from the way we think we perform services, the way providers have been taught to perform services, towards technology-driven healthcare, towards the utilization of online resources for healthcare, towards telehealth, and I believe a whole component of consumerism playing an active role in their healthcare. So I think that those changes are part of a long process that's certainly going to affect the way students get taught and also affect the way that clinicians have to practice in the new paradigm of healthcare.
I think it would be very helpful when you think about the college and you think about where we're going with education in the future. The value proposition of the Affordable Care Act that really begins to take a look at how physicians are going to be reimbursed, issues of quality, issues of efficiency, and so on, play an important role in really forming and influencing the clinical education process. You know, it would be helpful if you would share just what are some of those specific elements of the value proposition.
Well, if we look ahead to 2019, there is a plan to do away with current arrangements and to pay 90% of Medicare reimbursement initially and ultimately go towards the commercial sector of some kind of quality measures. The issue is that they're going to be looking at your relationship to your peers in the community. There are going to be 6,500 optometrists over the next week nationwide. They're going to be getting letters in the mail from the Center of Medicare and Medicaid ranking them or comparing them to colleagues in their catchment areas. So in other words, if Dr. Shulman performed OCTs twice as many times as I did, it's an indication to her that it may be perfectly acceptable, or that when I'm ranking you, I'm noticing you're doing a whole lot more testing than I'm doing. Doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong, or maybe I'm just underutilizing services, but it's an indication that the amount of tests that we're going to be doing are going to be looked at more frequently, and that is an indication of quality. We're also moving into mechanisms where data from electronic healthcare records are going to be dumped into huge databases within the country, and we're going to be able to compare the quality of care by some algorithms that are being developed to see who's a quality provider and who may not be as a quality provider. And the new models of reimbursement are going to take the numbers that we get in actual dollars and modify this by quality measures. And reimbursement in the year 2022 for all physicians across the board, including optometrists, could either go up 27% or down 9%.
One of the issues of quality measures really has to do with efficiency and appropriateness of testing. So it's not just against your peers. It's also looking at key metrics in terms of doing testing when it's appropriate, making sure you're not overutilizing it or underutilizing it. But appropriate is not just a measure of the rest of the population. It's also around the issue of clinical care guidelines and evidence-based
Because the question I have is that, you know, I mean, it's like we're searching for measures, right? And who's to say that, you know, who can put their finger on what the right numbers are of giving using OCTs or whatever? It's driven by patient
Let's take glaucoma as an issue. One of the issues that I've always been talking about with the introduction of ICD-10 is we really never had specific ways of determining reporting to the insurance company the severity of glaucoma. So
right.
One of the new criteria are going to be we're going to be required and we submit an ICD-10 code for glaucoma to indicate whether it's mild, moderate, severe. That again is going to profile a patient that is theoretically like any other patient, unless if the only two diagnoses are glaucoma and you have a moderate patient and I have a mild patient, well, how much testing are you doing on your moderate patient? How much testing am I doing on my mild patient? And how am I comparing to everybody else in the area? So even though the answer is how they're going to determine these measures, they're going to be able to compare us.
But they're also going to be looking to evidence-based clinical care guidelines development, mm-hmm. so that in the moderate glaucoma patient, there will be recommendations based upon the literature, including assessment of the quality of the study, as to how frequently that individual, for example, you know, should get good imaging done, you know, or visual fields testing.
That I think needs to be looked at is this conscious of attribution. I've heard this word bandied about a lot lately, whether it be on the Medicaid redesign program that's going on, whether it be in modifying or grouping patients for reimbursement, where a patient is going to be attributed to a entity. That entity might be a primary care doctor. That entity might also be an optometrist if they're the sole provider of all their cares. And they're going to track that person's that all the care that person is getting and attributed to that clinician or the majority of the clinician that takes it, and that's going to kind of give them a profile of what it is to take care of a patient.
So yeah. They're going to use big data to some extent and combine the provider-based and institutional-based measures, if you will. They'll combine it with Surescripts information, pharmacy information, right. to see if they're complying with their medication.
But even
the information that the doctor may not have, they'll have access to.
Right.
And to start making
but even in the context of bundled care payments, the value proposition in terms of the individual practitioner is going to enter into the equation.
Of course.
So no matter how you look at it, you know, when we are graduating students, you know, a student who graduates this year is going to be in a system in which they are assessed in terms of the quality of their care based upon these indicators. And I'm not sure it matters whether they're in a bundled
right.
system or whether they're reporting as an individual provider. You know, so it's going to be those issues of quality, evidence-based, efficiency of care, cost
care
containment,
coordination.
Care coordination, which are going to determine their success, you know, and as a result, you know, I think we as an institution do need to operate under the same constraints. So as you look at the way we care for our patients in the University Eye Center or the way we train our students to care for patients and the way we educate them, has to assume a world with these kinds of parameters.
I mean, one of the things that worries me is that embedded in this is the potential for something called regression to the mean. And, you know, the care that we provide could be based on average numbers in the population. And that worries me, because one of the things that we do here is we try to teach to the highest level of care. And when, you know, we don't know what some of these numbers are. How many OCTs do you need to have on a patient with a retinal disease, and, you know, that kind of a thing. So we try to teach, or our goal in our professional degree program is to teach students using evidence-based practice guidelines what the highest level of care is in any particular area.
But I don't know necessarily that average that's being benchmarked out there, that we would necessarily move towards that average. I would see us always excelling above that.
Right.
So I don't see us falling into the trap where we would be looked at as if we're not doing, you know.
No, I'm just saying that we will always teach that way.
Oh, right.
But then the systems that exist may tend to, you know, kind of stifle that.
But if our outcomes are still better, we're still going
to. Well, but I think if you to take this argument a little bit, in some ways, if you're looking at the reimbursement structure as an indicator of meeting the quality care guidelines, we want to be the institution that's getting paid 20%, 27% above. Now, on the other hand, you know, that may also be based upon a standard of care that is reflected by the average of the general practicing population, and it may be based upon guidelines that could be outdated. So the best example of this in medicine to me is off-label prescribing. You know, that's usually an effort by a provider to be creative in addressing a problem that is resistant to other forms of treatment. Now, to some degree, if you go off-label, you're automatically going to be an outlier. You know, if you try new strategies that haven't been tried before, you're going to be an outlier.
And I think there's another element where the consumerism takes into effect, because as the world shifts towards the patient being responsible for more of the cost of his care, whether that be through higher deductible, higher co-payments, or whatever model is in place, the number of patients that are going to be rolled on personal health care accounts or personal savings accounts are going to increase also. That's a model that's also being bandied about. You know, instead of an employee covering somebody under Plan X, they'll give them $5,000 a year and let them go get whatever their insurance is. And in that model, you're only going to get care that really you want to pay for care. When you enter consumerism into healthcare, it puts a twist. I mean,
but you're making an assumption that the patient's going to have the money to be able to have their own, you know,
but if the employer says, I'm going to give you, it costs me $5,000 a year to cover your life. Okay, it costs me $5,000. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you that $5,000. You go spend it any way you want.
So now you have to make the decision. Important to get your eyes checked and to come
right in. But I guess what I'm saying is, as you know, reimbursement is low, the high deductible costs of some of these plans, you know, the exchange programs weren't exactly what they were. I think people thought they were going to be. Yes, you're covered, but now the deductibles are mm-hmm. so high that you're running into patients having to make decisions. Well, am I going to spend money on health care, or am I going to spend money on food? And that's a reality. That's mm-hmm. the issue we're having with more of the uninsured. Not as much uninsured anymore. It's the underinsured.
Let me just shift the conversation a little bit, because I want to get back to the students and to the educational component. You know, when we... I mean, we already were talking about all of these various parameters. These pressures are already coming to bear in our own clinical facility. I mean, Erica, you're in the trenches with the students. You've been there certainly for the last few years. Where do you see the forces of healthcare reform in the healthcare delivery environment already impacting the teaching and education of the students?
So I think the first thing is teaching them efficiency. So right now, even as first years, they're being utilized as technicians in the clinic, and they're using autorefractors, autolensometers, to gather the information for the intern who will then be seeing the patient to save the intern time performing these tests. So they're learning how to utilize this technology to make the exam more efficient and to be able to spend less time with the patient, but still providing great care with the same outcome.
And how are the students responding to some of these changes or this emphasis, you know, on efficiency?
I mean, I think they like it. I think they always like having the most up-to-date technology and being able to utilize that to make themselves feel more efficient, and for them to be able to spend more chair time with the patient, being able to talk to the patient, explaining the findings, as opposed to just sitting behind instruments and pressing buttons. So they're able to speak with the patients more, explain the findings, and better care for the patients.
You want to disrupt it a little bit and make them uncomfortable, because it's easy to just go and do the lensometry and do all these little procedures.
and we want
they're
them
very good at it.
Right. But what does it mean?
You take that away, they don't have to do that. Now they have to
interpret
something else.
Yeah.
And so that puts a little bit of pressure and stress on them, but I think it's good pressure and stress.
Oh, no, absolutely. But I think we need to take advantage of those things that disrupt what has been the norm to date and to capitalize on it.
Well, if one of the outcomes of a focus on efficiency is really the utilization of technology and the utilization of ancillary staff, you know, as you say, less data gathering and more clinical thinking and application of the data. That obviously affects the clinical education, but that also extends down to the pre-clinical education. So if you think about the procedures coursework, what kind of changes have to be made in procedures in order to better prepare them for this environment?
So I guess when they're doing the procedure, they have to be knowing what they're looking for and how to utilize that information more. So they're not just doing a test, but what do the results of the test mean, and how do you then utilize that to determine an appropriate diagnosis and treatment plan?
It's always a challenge when you have a novice that has to have command over certain fundamentals before they can use it in an intermediate or advanced fashion. Our procedures course is evolving. We're trying to get the students to learn the skills and learn the procedures, but always with the mind toward how they'll be using them, not that they're just learning these for the sake of learning that skill or procedure. So, you know, this is coming along very well, I think, and we're making certain changes in the sequence that are taking hold. We've invested a large amount of money in the development of a simulation lab, a virtual reality simulation lab, for teaching of binocular indirect ophthalmoscopy. And the way that this will be taught with this virtual reality system will allow the students to learn the skills at their own pace, but then the way the software packages are designed around these simulators, with increasing proficiency, they'll be given more difficult cases that have actual retinal pathologies that they'll be looking at, and they'll be asked to do some analysis of those pathologies and develop some ideas about the case and the treatment of that virtual patient. So that will help prepare them better for entry into clinic, where they'll be seeing real patients with real diseases, and they won't necessarily be concentrating on the rudiments of doing the procedure.
But I think knowing how to do the skills is fundamental, because just last week I had a patient where the student ran an optos picture on, and there was this like black lesion, and she thought it was like a mass or something. She couldn't figure it out. She goes to do BIO, still couldn't figure it out, and what it was a pterygium, a growth on the cornea that casted a shadow. So it's like you have this optos amazing technology, but unless you know how to then use your clinical skills and interpretation.
But what a great experience for that student to go through that process and learn that lesson.
Correct.
And so, you know, that's why they call it practice.
Right.
I think another good component that exists and is getting a whole lot better in the clinic, but I think can also use improvement, is, you know, when I want to do a test, I mean, I would hope that there would be an understanding we're just not doing a test because we either want to get reimbursed for the test or we want to just do the test. But what is the medical necessity of doing that test? What information do I think I'm going to gather from that? I think if we could start utilizing students to think that way, we put them closer into the way healthcare is going. I mean, if you took the six of us in this room and did full body scans on every single one of us,
something.
I guarantee we would find something that would run into hundreds of thousands of dollars to rule out at the end of the day, it's probably nothing that's going to kill us, and if it's something that is. So I think I think that's an extreme example.
Notably, there's only six of us in the room, so that's a little scary.
Yeah.
But I think it's important. If you want to run a visual field, you should really have a very clear, concrete reason as to why I want to run a visual field. And, you know, that is establishing the medical necessity for a procedure. I think sometimes it's just easy to say, let's just run every test in the world and we'll see what comes out of it.
I think there's a real challenge here because optometry has always been a technically oriented profession. And now you have technology entering into the clinic, like the OPD system, right, which... the optical path diagnosis system with a couple of presses of buttons and you get enormous amounts of data. Now, are those data necessary? Or, you know, that's a question. And, you know, but it's so easy to collect those data now quickly that the clinician has to worry about reimbursement, but they're also being flooded with a lot of data that may be
unnecessary.
Irrelevant to what they're doing.
Provide the care.
Yeah. Aren't you then raising the issue of using equipment like that is really being used as a screening technique, right, not as a directed diagnostic strategy?
Right. And then the doctor receiving that data has to be really good at knowing what it is that they want, right, what's extraneous, what's important.
To what degree? You know, and this is to what degree, I guess the question is, to what degree are we, or to what degree will we, or should we, in providing education within the patient care setting? Part of our job is to have our students be very cognizant of and aware of the elements of healthcare reform and what are the principles that guide behavior and treatment and diagnosis. Are we making the link in the care of our patients, you know, to these parameters in terms of explicit? And we may do it by through role modeling. We may say, you know, we're doing this technique because of this medical necessity. But are we actually saying to the students, and do we need to say to the students, you know, we are doing this, and it's important to recognize that this is basically being done out of medical necessity, and that's an important part of healthcare. I mean, are we really teaching healthcare paradigms as a part of patient care paradigms?
I mean, I think it's a little of both, because since we are an educational institution, I'm trying to think of like a case. Sometimes I'll have a diabetic patient with a lot of dot-blot hemes that the student misses. Mm-hmm. So I then have to take a fundus photo to show them where the hemes are or where different retinal findings are located.
Are you taking the fundus photo to show them, or are you taking the fundus photo because it's good care for the patient to have?
So, I mean, it's a little bit of both. If the patient had a fundus photo a month ago, I wouldn't need to necessarily take another fundus photo.
So it's kind of interesting is, you know, would you take another fundus photo if another one had been done the month before?
I wouldn't need to if I was just the clinician, but if you have a student who misses dot-blot hemes, a flame-shaped hemorrhage, you want to show them where it is, so you have to...
Well, there's a difference between what you do for patient care and what you do
for education.
For student education.
Well, but again, depending upon, you know, how what you're doing for student education, which whenever you do something on a patient, it really does have to be recorded in the patient record. Mm-hmm. You're suddenly altering, you know, the reality of care.
Well, this is where I work, because, you know, yeah, maybe you do it and we eat the cost because we are an educational institution. But I worry if we are going to get nicked, as you put it earlier, because of what we're doing for the patient care. And there's got to, you know, because if that drives our decision making, it's going to affect the way we educate. And ultimately, it could affect the way the care that the patients get.
Right.
So, and on the other hand, the way we educate could affect the care we provide and the patient care outcome if we're not careful.
Well, yeah.
Each could be detrimental.
I'm less worried about that because I think that if we do more in teaching our students,
you're doing better.
We'll have more information to work with. And that will, I believe, will translate to better patient care. But
they're
those are two
it.
Great examples, okay, that Erica just gave us. That you have a diabetic patient with a retinal pathology that was missed. Now, the doctor caught it. Now, let's go back in time, you know, 5 years, only 5 years. They didn't have the ability to do the image that mm-hmm. you could just do mm-hmm. easily with the push of the button and show the student and then have the student go back in and look for that very same thing again. And now the student has learned a new concept, a new mm-hmm. Procedural-based approach, and they're going to be better.
Well, but some of this then also gets into our investment in technology. Because I could also argue that in order to provide compliant patient care, while also being able to demonstrate it, you could argue that every room should be equipped with a video-based mm-hmm. binocular indirect, mm-hmm. so that whatever you're doing as a doc is on the screen,
so they can see,
and you don't have to do.
Yeah, but I would even say that's even older technology. Because if I was just going to finish my statement that. You know, if we go back 5 years and you don't have that technology, what do you have to do? You have to rely on something like that, if you have it.
Right.
Or you saying, okay, I want you to go back in there and look again. Do you see that? You know, here, look at this. And then you're slowing the exam down. It's less efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have great potential to teach better and more efficiently.
But I get concerned about, will the record substantiate what was done to the patient? I think the key area is not so much the dollar amount that we're getting reimbursed, but on audits, can that record survive an audit based upon what was written, what was documented, what was contained in the record?
And that's the key thing for students to leave here understanding,
right, absolutely.
So that when they're out there in practice, they're very
right.
much aware of what is needed to be documented in order to get paid and to provide right. quality care.
So should every student be assigned a quality assurance review session?
I would say yes.
I think so.
I would say yes.
Okay.
I think there's great value to looking at records and seeing and benefiting from what other people have.
You know, the other thing is that I think it's important to understand is that, if we look at the paradigms of care coordination, of everything that's going on, that record really needs to paint the picture of the health of that patient, all right? So in other words, if we ever do get involved in differential fee reimbursement based on diagnosis, I think in the old paradigm, the old system, someone came in with was a diabetic, you diagnosed diabetic retinopathy. Now, if you addressed in that conversation the cataract that may be related to
right.
the diet, to the diabetic, you talk about the need for education of perhaps of podiatric care, and you start using all the available ICD-10 codes that will paint the picture of the patient, you have the potential of utilizing new paradigms in reimbursement when they're established. Right now, I think all providers tend to go by the primary diagnosis.
Let me throw out a different measure. I mean, one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act is to get patients to be more actively engaged in their own care. And I'm not sure how they're going to really measure that or how they're going to evaluate it. But ideally, you know, patients should be educated. So if you use the CITT study as an example, they should know that they can, pursue treatment strategy 1, 2, 3, or by the way, there's a clinical study.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the patient's choice or understanding their choices and taking responsibility for the decision is supposed to be a goal. I don't know how that's going to be operationalized. Maybe you do.
Well, I would think that clinical entities may be rewarded, hospitals and clinics such as DNCs may be rewarded more because there is an educational or research component, not an educational component. I don't think you're going to get reimbursed anymore for education, but supposedly referring for research. Now, you know, again, I could give you an answer right now. If I spent more than 50% of an encounter educating the patient or coordinating that patient's care, we could up the level of reimbursement by one notch. I mean, there's a perfect example.
I also think that once we get into the realm of patient portals and mm-hmm. having the opportunity for patients to engage with us, I think those are going to be measured. They're going to look at how many people are enrolled in your portal, how much communication is happening with the provider, what type of communication, is it medication refill, is it spectacle order, is it urgent care type situation, e-visits. I think all of those things we're going to be measured on.
So theoretically, the patient portal will be an avenue to make the patient aware of clinical studies that they
absolutely
may be eligible for.
But we're talking about not just studies, we're talking about improving public health, population health, you know. And it would allow us greater avenues to be creative in terms of effectuating care
but take
and
it
the
one
quality
step.
Of their care.
A patient portal is a requirement for meaningful use. Meaningful use is one of those things that are going to give you a plus factor in the 2019 theoretically proposed new treatment model. So if I don't use a patient portal, I may get dinged. If I use one, I may get rewarded. So, I mean, those are some of the issues that when you take some of these, the things that we're talking about, enrollment of studies and things like that can be done through patient portal or education, it is going to be tied in a measurement performance just by the fact that we have a patient portal.
Clearly, what healthcare reform is really trying to do is improve patient care outcomes. And I think there's a large body of evidence within the public health literature that obviously coordinating care between different disciplines is very effective in improving patient care outcomes, particularly as it relates to hospitalization or rehospitalization over time. You know, and so I do take a look, and I do think one of our great challenges as an institution is providing that interprofessional experience and developing the interprofessional competencies that are going to be required. We do have a lot of areas. I mean, where we don't have as much experience is really from a medical perspective, although we try to get that through off-site clinical rotations, and we need to be more cognizant of providing those experiences. But in-house, while it may be limited, I mean, I think that the vision therapy rehabilitative area is a great example where you can have interprofessional collaboration. Particularly if you're dealing with psychoeducational assessments and perceptual assessments and dealing with schools and pediatricians, the opportunities are significantly there. Certainly in low vision rehabilitation, you're dealing with social workers, you're dealing with counselors, other care providers, if you do it right.
But I think the students understand the importance for any diabetic patient. They'll always ask, when was the last time you saw the endocrinologist? They'll always write a report of the current exam findings with the dilation reports and have that mailed to the patient to give to their endocrinologist. Even one of my head trauma patients who had a brain tumor, they asked the last time they saw the neurologist, it's been a long time. So we gave a copy of their visual field and mailed a report to the neurologist. So the students are always interacting with a multitude of professionals.
I think, though, as David mentioned, I think we have to remember that the end result of interprofessional education is to improve patient care outcomes. And, you know, if you look at a hospital setting, it's a whole lot easier to render interprofessional care in those locations because you can almost have a team of doctors hovering over a patient, where we just don't have those opportunities here. So the measurement of true interprofessional care is to increase the outcomes. So somehow we have to get our students more involved in the total care of the patients, either through interaction with other disciplines in this building or outside of this building.
Because otherwise, let's take the example of sending information back to neurologists. We have no idea if the neurologist gets the information.
Correct.
Whether they agree, disagree, if there's something
right,
else.
And
if
they
have
so
if they even
right.
read it or
yeah.
does right. the reception
so
file
So where is
in
that
the
interaction?
Yeah.
So, you know, when we talk about technology advances, are there opportunities via the portal to do some work? There's some software coming out. Recently I heard, even with our current product, on care coordination, and we were interested in that because there's an opportunity there to communicate with our referring providers via a secure portal, which then, you know, the PHI issue is not, you know, there's no HIPAA, no privacy issue there, because they would basically get an account, you know, log on.
Right.
So they would have access to the patients they refer to us. that's where there's a great opportunity to have that care coordination, yeah. not just sending reports back and forth. Because that's not, you know, that's not true communication. That's just relaying some information,
right.
but you don't know what they do with the lives.
That's being coordinated.
You don't even know if they're really going back to that doctor.
That's very true.
That's
yeah.
passive versus
so I think we're going to have great opportunities. The other thing is with not just the patient portal, the health information exchanges, and the idea that you could drop this clinical care document, this CCD document, of every time you see your patient, we can automatically drop that document into the HIE. That means that if that patient's enrolled in a Bronx HIE or a Manhattan one or whichever one, okay. that doctor would have access to anyone that mm-hmm. patient says they can have access to their information. So if they know they've come to the UEC and they have given access, that doctor would be able to see that information. That's powerful.
That's huge.
Yeah. So whether they go to an emergency room or not, that information would be there.
What's critical for any healthcare professions educational institution is that we have to move into the mode of anticipating the future and preparing our students for that eventuality. We really cannot continue to simply react to the environment, you know, after things occur.